Dave Zirin is the sports editor of The Nation, a columnist for The Progressive, and the host of Edge of Sports podcast. His many books include A People's History of Sports in the United States. His new book is The Kaepernick Effect, Taking a Knee, Changing the World. The book is published by the New Press, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Dave Zirin to the roundtable this morning. Dave, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate having you here.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
What brought you to the topic?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, what first brought me to the topic was a discussion I had with 1968 Olympian John Carlos, who, of course, raised his fist on the medal stand in 1968 in that iconic pose. John said to me, you know, there were many people who raised their fist at various track meets after we did so. And I said, well, who were they? What happened to them? And he said, I don't know. They were just people who did it. And of course, there was no way to find those people. It's been over 50 years. But I thought about all of the folks who had taken a knee or raised their fist during the anthem to protest racial inequity and police brutality after Colin Kaepernick did so. And I thought that we were forgetting how many people were involved in that process. I mean, there were hundreds, if not thousands, of athletes who did that. And I wanted to tell their stories. Now, that was the first motivation for the book. But the second one happened as I was writing it during the summer of 2020, when you had all the demonstrations after the killing of George Floyd. And it occurred to me that, wow, you know, many roads have led us to this moment in the summer of 2020 with these protests. But one of the roads really does run through the athletic fields of this country. And so I wanted to tell that story about why it is that so many athletic fields in the United States became jumping off points to what was the largest set of protests in the history of the United States.
Based solely on the fact that he is not currently playing the game at this moment, that idea of him taking a knee and joining that tradition that you just outlined of American athletes making political statements, it did not work out well for him.
No. He has found himself out of work for the last 4 years. His last season in the NFL was 2016. I mean, and what it does is it exposes a lie about the National Football League. You know, one of the expressions of the NFL comes from Vince Lombardi, the great old Packers coach, who said, winning isn't everything, it's the only thing. Well, I think a lot of franchises are showing that maybe winning isn't the only thing, because they have chosen instead to collude against someone who is very able to play the quarterback position, the most important position in football, rather than worry about winning. They have decided that Colin Kaepernick has more value as a ghost story to be used to haunt young players against performing such protests than he does as terms of his value as a quarterback.
So these young athletes, and maybe even not so young, who are joining him and echoing his action that you wanted to look at, of that Kaepernick effect, you were ultimately concerned, and you say this in the preface, that because we have a short attention span culture, that these protests would be forgotten and perhaps already are being forgotten.
Yeah, that was why I wanted to put the book together initially, because I was concerned about, you know, them being memory hold the same way all of the activists or young people, athletes who were influenced by Tommy Smith and John Carlos were memory hold. I want their memory to be known, because I think that's very important to our understanding of history, not just sports history, but history as a whole. Because sometimes in this country, what we do is we celebrate the individual, like a Martin Luther King, for example, without looking at the grassroots context by which these individuals come out of. And by extolling the individual instead of the mass of people who are doing the work, you also tend to set up this weird dichotomy of heroes and normal people. And the heroes are on this pedestal, and we could never be like them. All we could do is look at them and admire. I didn't want that to be part of Colin Kaepernick's story, because it's not just about him.
It isn't just about him, and I want to get to the others in a moment, but what is fascinating about him, and you make this point early in the book, is that here is a guy who is an introvert. He's an introverted guy.
Yes.
He was not seeking publicity, and yet he did something that got a ton of publicity and became, yes, an issue during a political campaign.
Exactly. What I find so fascinating about the Kaepernick story is that, you know, he didn't start by taking a knee and issuing some press release and making it this public spectacle. He started in August 2016, sitting on the bench during the anthem behind his teammates, really out of a sense of disgust, because that summer had seen several high-profile killings by police, one of Alton Sterling, one of Philando Castile, that were caught on videotape. And so it was traumatic and upsetting, and there were protests and throughout that summer. And Colin Kaepernick was reflecting that level of upset. And it might have only been a one-week thing that we would not be talking about today, except there was a terrific reporter on the scene named Steve Weish, who'd been following Colin Kaepernick's social media and, frankly, had known him since he was in college 10 years earlier. And he made a beeline for Colin and said, "I saw you sitting on the bench during the anthem. What's up with that?" And Colin responded with an absolute, you know, off the top digression about everything that was wrong with policing in the United States. And that's what set things off. The wheel was in motion.
And it doesn't make sense to me, and even in reading the book, I haven't quite got a handle of why then he is still being ostracized for something that, as you point out, through these athletes has become rather commonplace.
Yeah, it can be a mystery to me too, because I thought the NFL was all about winning. But the only conclusion that I can draw is that they've decided that it's more important to keep him out of the league as a way to discipline their current workforce and to tell the players, you know, this can happen to you. Because remember, in the NFL, they don't have guaranteed contracts. The typical career only lasts 3.5 years. And this is really the moment that I think NFL owners have always feared, that moment where players start to say, wait a minute, this entire setup is not very just, given that this is a multi-billion dollar business and we're the ones putting our blood, sweat, and tears on the line. And keeping him out is a very important hedge against players demanding and asking for more.
And just so I make sure that I've got this right in my brain, there are athletes who are currently playing the game who have been charged with assault,
yes,
rape, drug charges, even murder, and yet they play, and his peaceful protest of taking a knee has gotten him kicked out of the league.
Just a bridge too far. And one of the things about those other players that you mentioned, usually before they get back into the league after their criminal offenses, they have to do some kind of apology tour, either privately with the commissioner,
right,
Roger Goodell, or publicly on television, usually with someone sitting by their side, a pastor or something very, very performative like that. Colin Kaepernick was offered something similar, but he refused to apologize because he doesn't think, and I certainly don't think, he did anything wrong. He did something that is very much in the American tradition of expressing dissent. And his refusal to break, his refusal to apologize, might be his biggest offense of all in the eyes of the NFL powers that be.
Dave Zirin is our guest on the roundtable this morning. The new book, The Kaepernick Effect, Taking a Knee, Changing the World. The way you have broken up the book is fascinating to me. There are basically three chapters: high school, mm-hmm, college, the pros. Why did you look at it that way, of taking those three steps of professional sports?
Well, I mean, a lot of thought went into that. You know, like, how should we separate it by sport, by the degree of threat maybe that a person faced, by, you know, there are all kinds of ways we could have done it. I made sure to have a lot of women athletes represented in the book. And so it's like, should we divide it by gender? And what I ended up coming to was, you know what, there's a very distinct set of risks, whether you're a high school student, a college student, or a professional. You know, we all remember what it was like in high school, the difficulties in standing out, of being teased, and all the rest of it. And so that's a very specific kind of challenge that one has to overcome. The collegiate level, you know, you're on scholarship, and these scholarships are renewed on an annual basis. A lot of people don't know that. And so stepping out, upsetting your coach, taking a knee, you know, there's a different set of risks than in high school. And of course, at the professional level, you're talking about a paycheck. You know, you're talking about your platform. You're talking about all kinds of privileges and entitlements that come with a professional being a professional athlete, and you're risking that as well. So it's not that one is more dangerous or less dangerous than the other. It's just that the risk assessments at these different stages of life are all very different. So I wrote a lot about what unites them, but also what separates these different stages.
Tell me about Preston Brown.
Oh, I mean, he's a coach, and that's what makes his story so important to the story. Preston Brown from Camden, I mean, one of the really difficult places in which to grow up in this country. Preston Brown is somebody who actually supported his team's right to take a knee. And that's something very specific and different, because in some of these cases, the coaches very much line up against the player. In other cases, the coach tries to use this as an educational opportunity. And Preston Brown's in that category of a coach who tried to view this as a way to help his players mature and grow. And that, to me, marks the difference of a coach who's in it for themselves and their own ego gratification, or a coach who's in it because he or she really wants to develop the minds of the young people who are in their charge. So that's Preston Brown. And I was glad to tell his story, or the story of Coach Joey Thomas out at Garfield High School in Seattle, because the story of heroic coaches is also very important in this, even if the examples are few and far between.
I chose Coach Brown to ask you about because you write, he also has something to say big picture about the confluence of sports and patriotism, which is such a feature of the post 9/11 world. He says, quote, "When I was growing up in middle school and playing youth football, I never remember a single game where they played the national anthem, not one. When I was in college at Tulane, we'd be in the locker room. Now I'm at youth games for 5- and 6-year-olds, and they're making loud announcements saying everybody needs to stand up. And I'm thinking, why are they making such a huge deal about it? They're trying to intertwine sports and patriotism, and they are not synonymous." So how did that come to be, that idea, that it is such a big deal?
Yeah, I mean, well, you got to go back to World War I. I mean, that's when we start playing the national anthem in sporting events, and then it stops. And it starts up again in World War II. But then after World War II, it just continues as a tradition. And it was really a signal to the country about the Cold War, that we are entering really a permanent state of war. And then that gets ramped up to an even another level, as you mentioned, after 9/11. And then the NFL, after 9/11, they engage in what's called a salute to service financial partnership with the Pentagon, that turns the playing of the national anthem into a military ceremony. And part of the deal at the Pentagon involved players being out of the locker room, you know, standing at attention for the anthem. And so that's the situation. It was really the NFL post 9/11 that turned that anthem space into something very politicized. And they shouldn't be surprised that a player, and more than one player, decided, well, if this is going to be a contested political space, then I'm going to enter that contest.
Dave Zirin is our guest, and the name of the book is The Kaepernick Effect. You mentioned something at the beginning about there were many ways to kind of chop up the book, if you will, and segment it, and one of the ways that you thought of was by sport. Can you talk a little bit about when we're talking about pro sports, are there some sports that seem to have it together better than others? Because we certainly think of football as being the big one, but obviously it has impacted all sports.
It has impacted all sports. The thing about football is that it's by far the most popular sport, the closest thing to a monocultural product that we have in this country. I mean, it's ridiculous. Like something like of the 18 most watched television events in 2019, I might not have this perfectly, but something like 17 out of 18 were NFL games. I mean, it's hegemonic in a way that other sports simply are not. But in the book, you know, I talk to people who range from, you know, softball and lacrosse to baseball to soccer. I mean, every sport, and that's what Colin Kaepernick gave. more than anything else, he gave a language and a method to protest that otherwise did not exist. And so if you're an athlete and you're disgusted about the state of things and, you know, there's not a demonstration happening right outside your door, here was something tangible that you could do that before Colin Kaepernick did not exist.
So were there leagues within the pros, whether it be the MLB, the NBA, the NFL, that did better than others when it came to dealing with players and coaches who wanted to take a stand?
Yeah, the NBA and the WNBA did a lot better than all the other leagues. And I think one of the reasons for that is, in two words, LeBron James. LeBron James is a generational talent, the most important NBA player since Michael Jordan. And LeBron James decided that he was going to be a political athlete, and he was going to use social media to be a political athlete. And for LeBron, it started, like it did for so many of the athletes who I spoke with, it started with the killing of Trayvon Martin in Florida by George Zimmerman, and the fact that no justice came out of that case. LeBron James took part in a posed photo with his Miami Heat teammates of them all wearing hoodies. And that became like the first viral sports politics photograph. Mm. And that was in 2012. And LeBron realized that, well, I have quite a platform to do something with this. And, you know, the NBA is not going to witch hunt LeBron James out of the league. I mean, Colin Kaepernick was at a very precarious point in his career. And they made the calculus, I would argue, that, well, we can live without him. And it's better to have him as that ghost story that we talked about. To scare players into staying in line. You couldn't witch hunt LeBron James out of the NBA. Way too valuable a person for that league. And LeBron James then effectively bent the entire NBA to being more accepting of social protest. And that had a force field effect and a ripple effect on the entire league.
You look in this book at this whole national movement of athletes and citizen athletes who are fighting and fighting for racial justice. And I was watching football this weekend, like millions of others, and it's kickoff weekend, and I see 67,000 people in a stadium in Florida, and okay, how many are vaccinated? Who's wearing a mask? Okay, let's put that aside,
yeah.
Although it's really hard. And then on in the end zone are the words, end racism. And your head just wants to explode because it doesn't make sense. And I don't even know how you could do that without being called out for your hypocrisy. And I don't know why they're not being called out for their hypocrisy louder than they are. Yeah, no, I know you're trying, but to the point, Dave, and I don't know, here's my issue. Then I feel guilty for even watching the damn thing.
Well, look, I mean, especially these days, it's a tough world in which we live. And, you know, I watched the games this weekend with my kid. You know, I have nothing against anybody for looking for any kind of escape during what can be, you know, very frustrating or sometimes
sure.
pessimistic times in which we live. The NFL, what they've been doing is the oldest trick in the book. Commissioner Roger Goodell, it's the carrot and the stick. And so they realized that they had a restive giant on their hands in terms of black NFL players and their dissatisfaction with the world and the dissatisfaction with the NFL ownership. And so the NFL starts doing things like allowing social justice organizing if it's done through acceptable channels. That's now allowed in the NFL. Roger Goodell said during the summer of 2020, that, you know, the NFL should have listened more to what Colin Kaepernick was trying to say. You know, they put those slogans in the end zone about ending racism. They let players put some decals on their helmets. That's the carrot. But then you have the stick. Colin Kaepernick, not working. Eric Reed, who I interview in the book, another NFL player who protested, not working. Kenny Stills, another NFL player who I interviewed in the book, not working. That's the other side of it, is, you know, making sure that, you know, players know, like, okay, we're going to be more accepting of and more listening to your issues, but there will be a price to pay if you step too far out of line.
This may be an unfair question because I'm not sure. I just don't know if there is an answer to this question. But do we know what, at this point, Colin Kaepernick still wants?
Well, I mean, he's wanted for 5 years the chance to actually play for an NFL team. I mean, he still works out 6 days a week. The collusion against him is absurd. And it's a bigger deal than I think sometimes we make it. Because it's a very high-profile example of somebody being punished for their speech. And that, I would argue, has a chilling effect on the broader country. So I've always thought it should be even a bigger deal than we're making it. But that's one thing he wants. He also wants to see some certain political objectives about policing in this country change. And I think we're going to be hearing a lot more from him in the next year than we have in the last 5 years about that issue as well.
The name of the book is The Kaepernick Effect, Taking a Knee, Changing the World. Are you optimistic that we will help change the world? Not that sports can do it all by itself.
I wasn't before I did this book, being really, really frank with you. But talking to all these young people and being immersed in their lives during those first months of the pandemic and then through the summer last year, it actually has made me a more optimistic person. Because I figure if this generation's not going to put up with it, and if they haven't, you know, surrendered to either apathy or cynicism, then what right do I have to do the same?
Dave Zirin is our guest. The name of the new book is The Kaepernick Effect, Taking a Knee, Changing the World. The book is published by The New Press. Dave, great job in this book. Thank you very much for sharing with us. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Be well. Thank you. Again, the name of the book is The Kaepernick Effect by Dave Zirin, Taking a Knee, Changing the World. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.